Five trains later, I'm getting frustrated. I'm like, okay, regardless of how many people are on the train, I'm gonna dive in. There's 10 people around me, okay, 10 guys around me. Train comes in, the carriage is full. I'm like, there's no way we're getting into the train, but I'm sick of waiting. So we go, all 10 of us at the same time, get in the train, and for whatever reason, we all fit. And like, there's no conflict, it just happens miraculously. And I'm like, this is really strange. So that's my first experience with Japan. On my way to the airport to the hotel, I'm sitting and I realize, and it's shocking to me, it's like, there's no beeping. Like, we're on the highway, we're going really fast from the airport to the hotel, and there's just no beeping. I say to my friend picking up at the airport, and I asked her, like, why does no one beep in Japan? And she's like, because it's bad manners. And I'm like, yes, it is bad manners, but we beep all the time in China, so why is no one beeping in Japan? So that's the second story. And the third story is, we get to the hotel, and a podcast invited me to Japan, the Nikomon podcast, so a very deep thank you for inviting me to Japan. And they're paying for the hotel, but the hotel needs a credit card for just as a credit card. And so I take out my wallet, my credit card, I give it to the hotel staff. And she comes back and says, it says debit card. And I'm like, I know it says debit card, but it's a credit card, trust me. She goes back to talk to her manager, like 10 minutes later, they come back and say, it's a debit card. It's like, it's both a debit card and a credit card. They're like, it's a debit card. It's a credit card, trust me. And like, after a bit, I'm like, fine, here's your credit card. And you know, it's, and like, yes, thank you, okay? So those are my three stories of Japan so far. And the point is that these stories basically confirm to me my suspicions about Japan before I came here, which is that Japan is extremely harmonious society, which is very cohesive, and where people are able to start to synchronize just subconsciously. So think of the subway, the train story, where everyone knows how to fit into the train without actually coming into conflict with each other. That's very impressive. At the same time, Japanese are very rules obsessed, right? It's like, if you need a credit card, it can't be a debit card, it has to be a credit card. It can't be both a credit card and a debit card, it has to be a credit card. So those are my impressions of Japan so far. I was on a Nakamon podcast this afternoon. We talked for 3 hours. And I basically laid out my understanding of what's happening in East Asia. I think that right now there are two major flashpoints in the world. You have the Middle East, you have Ukraine. I think the third flashpoint will be East Asia. But I think like East Asia will be the most complicated, because you have some pretty sophisticated geopolitical actors in East Asia, including South Korea, North Korea, China, Japan, Taiwan, Philippines, Australia. So it's a very complicated situation. But I'll just summarize for you what we really talk about. So the U.S. strategy is to retreat or remove itself from providing security guarantees in East Asia. Because for the past 50, 60 years, it's America that guaranteed peace in East Asia. And as a result, the East Asian economies have skyrocketed. They boomed these few decades. But from the American perspective, that's not really sustainable, because it means paying for the upkeep of like 50,000 troops in South Korea, 50,000 troops in Japan. America doesn't really want to do that anymore. So America wants to retreat. And once America retreats, there'll be two points of contention in East Asia. The first, of course, will be Taiwan, where China, the Chinese strategy is to, over time, economically unify with Taiwan, right? So the idea is that as the global economy becomes worse and worse, Taiwan will become much more dependent on China, and this will lead ultimately to political reunification. Okay, so that's a Chinese strategy. From the Japanese perspective, that would be a disaster, because if Taiwan were to reunify with China, this would create an embargo on Japan, right? Because Japan needs to access the resources of Southeast Asia, Taiwan would block Southeast Asia from Japan, and this would create long-term security issues for Japan. So Japan cannot allow that. And so Japan is very quickly reunifying, and we can see a lot of points of contention in the shipping lanes of Southeast Asia. Okay, so, but China doesn't actually want to engage with Japan. The Chinese strategic mentality is to avoid confrontation and to use other mechanisms, economic coercion, diplomacy, in order to resolve military disputes. So I think the Chinese strategy will be to use North Korea as a point of leverage, right? So the idea is you're North Korea and you're poor, but because you're poor, you have nothing to lose in this game, right? So North Korea threatens South Korea with artillery, and then North Korea were to lobby missiles in the Sea of Japan, this would create a lot of crisis in East Asia, in which case Japan would need to negotiate with China in order to keep North Korea at bay. Okay, so that's China's strategy. And the Japanese strategy would be, Japan is actually in a lot of trouble because there are three major issues. The first major issue is aging crisis, right? So every nation in the world faces an aging crisis, but Japan is far ahead of the curve. Japan is aging faster than other nations. And this is causing a lot of problems in Japan, especially immigration, right? Because you have to bring immigrants in order to keep the economy going. The second major issue is Japan is not self-sufficient in the way that the United States and China are self-sufficient. Japan is very dependent on imports and exports to feed its economy, to feed its people, basically. And the third issue is that Japan has a lot of historical enemies in East Asia. So historically, Japan has had feuds with the Korean Peninsula, with China, with Southeast Asia. So the geopolitical outlook is not great for Japan. And I think that over the next 10 years will be critical for Japan, because either Japan solves its demographic crisis right now, over these next 10 years, basically its aging crisis. If it does not solve this problem in the next 10 years, I think Japan will cease to exist as a nation state in 50 years' time. That's how serious this problem is. Okay? The aging crisis is a huge problem in Japan. And so what I said in the podcast, and we can talk about this, is what Japan is facing is a stark choice that other nations won't face, but which Japan has to resolve by itself. And so I think Japan, in the next 10 years, will attempt to resolve its demographic crisis by introducing mass euthanasia. Okay, that's our prediction. I think Japan will be forced into making this choice, where the only way for the nation to survive is by encouraging those who are over 80 to do euthanasia. And I don't see any other path. Okay, it's either Japan makes this choice or Japan ceases to exist in 50 years' time. I mean, and this is something we debate, right? And so we're joking on the podcast because, I mean, this is a very, grim topic. And I was joking that the solution is to get these old people to use psychedelics, right? If they use psychedelics, they will see that death is actually meaningless. And this is something that has a lot of validity, because we know people who have near-death experiences, And after they die, they recognize that, you know what, death is just the beginning. There are also people who have cancer, and for the longest time, they were just dreading death. But the moment they start using psychedelics as part of their therapy, they start to be more welcoming, they start to be more open-minded about the possibility of death. They don't fear death. And the moment you start to lose the fear of death, is the moment that you live life to your fullest. Okay? So it may mean that you die, but it also means like before you die, you are really motivated to make the best of your time. So you spend more time with your family, you spend more time doing what you love rather than just threatening. Okay? So the first comment is, we know exactly what will happen if this trend continues, where the elite are getting older and older and increasing surrender power. Okay? So what's going to happen is something called Grand Utopia. And this was an experiment conducted by James P. Calhoun in the 60s and 70s. Okay? So basically, he was interested in population growth and what it would mean for society. You have abundance. So what would abundance mean for humanity? So he created this experiment where he took a room and turned it into a colony for rats. And in this room, he created a paradise, like just free water, free food every day, no predators. And so these rats could just do whatever they wanted. And then he put these rats in this colony. And he tried this experiment for like dozens of times. And each time, every single time, it ended with a mass extinction of the colony. All the rats ended up dying. Okay? The reason why was, in nature, male rats fight over breeding rights. And the strongest rat, the alpha rat, gets to have his wife and then have children. And the other rats run off to start their own colonies or die out in nature. Okay? So it's about the fittest, basically. And that's just the rule of nature. But in this scenario, Rat Utopia, no one dies. And even though the alpha male rats, they're able to feed up the other rats have no place to go. So they just hang out together, and eventually they gang up on the alpha male rat. The alpha male rat's trying to protect his family, but eventually he's just so sick of fighting rats over and over, he just runs away. And then the other rats come and rape the female rat. And then the female rat is so sick of fighting all these rats that she loses her mind and she starts attacking her own children. And then these children run off, and because there's no animal protection, they also join this feral group of rats. And then you have gang warfare. Okay? And so this wasn't going to happen to society if this trend continues where the boomers refuse to give up power. Okay? You just imagine a scenario where you have a lot of young men, and right now they distract themselves with like OnlyFans and like Bitcoin and Dupage and pornography, right? But eventually you reach a point where they form into groups, and now it's just urban warfare, it's a civil war throughout. Okay, and eventually society's like, screw this, we're gonna send these men off to die in war in order to maintain social stability. So you destroy your own society by killing off the young. Okay, but that's the only path forward if you don't allow the proper transfer of power from the old to the young. The society will die out. And this is something that every major industrial economy faces today. Not just Japan, but China, United States, Canada, Australia, Europe, everyone. Okay? And I think that my analysis of Japan would have the cultural resilience to resolve this issue. Okay? Because the trick for the future is not to actually win wars. You can't do that nowadays with nuclear weapons. The trick is to maintain cultural cohesion and vitality. That means the old have to surrender power to the young. And only in Japan, I think, could that happen. I'm not saying it will happen. I'm saying, like, of all these societies that I see, I think only Japan to pull this off. And if Japan pulls this off, then I can see Japan becoming the superpower of East Asia. Okay? It's the most pressing problem for humanity. Okay, that's our first comment. The second comment is, why is this happening? Why is it the old refuse to surrender power? And we've never had a situation like this in human history before, right? Well, I mean, primarily because we never had so much peace and prosperity before in human history. So it's impossible for the old to live this long. But now that they're like 80, 90, like, you know, Chuck Grassley's at 90 years old, why don't they just like retire and give it to someone who is more capable? And I think the answer is because we've adopted an extremely materialistic worldview which worships individual achievement, right? So we worship people like Elon Musk when you become a trillionaire, but we also worship people who live to 100 years old, right? It's like, wow, what an amazing individual achievement, right? And like, you know, in a lot of places, if you live to 100 years old, you get a visit by the mayor, there's a parade for you, it's a huge celebration. And you should be celebrated for living to 100 years old. But we don't think about the cost of having people live this long. Okay, so we adopt this extremely materialistic worldview that is competitive, that is individualistic, that is extremely selfish. And we reward people for that. So I think the only solution moving forward is to adopt a much more nationalistic, much more religious worldview, which is say, you know, it's proper good to sacrifice yourself for the greater good. It's a noble thing to think of community before you think of the individual. And again, all the societies that I see around me, China, the United States, Europe, I think only Japan can pull this off. It is very true that the young people seem apathetic today. It seems as though they're no longer interested in politics, they're no longer angry. It seems as though the internet has been able to channel a lot of their anger away. They spend a lot of their time watching porn, playing video games, and apparently that has sort of dissipated their natural anger. I think that's incorrect. I think we need to look, we have to use a longer time horizon. And so the example I would use is the 1844 revolutions, which really destroyed old Europe. And what sparked the revolution was famine. It was a climate change, wet weather, which caused the potato famine, it caused all starvation, and that's when the entire society started to burn. Okay? So the idea that today, well, the young people can just watch porn online and like get food delivered to them using Uber Eats, yeah, okay, sure. But let's imagine a scenario where the global supply chain chokes up and they're not able to access food. Well, now that they're hungry, now that the economy has collapsed around the world, now I think they're angry, okay? And so the surgical moves is a huge issue, and no one really appreciates what this really means for the global supply chain and the global food supply, right? Because, yeah, I mean, sure, the surgical moves, a lot of energy bypasses through that, but you know what? A lot of fertilizer bypasses through that as well. Okay, about 20% of the world's fertilizer goes through that. And most of the world depends on fertilizer, especially the global south, right? So imagine a scenario where there's famine in Africa, and it's gonna have huge repercussions for the world because then you have this mass migration into Europe, and then this is gonna destabilize society. And once, you know, the thing about history is, once a spark starts, every place gets ignited. Okay, so I think it's easy to say, okay, well, we're special, and we've solved the food problem, we've solved the abundance issue, so we're kind of immune from history. I would disagree. I think the entire world that we live in is much more fragile than we think. Like, can you imagine, like, 2 years ago, the United States would screen in Iran, fighting this pointless war, destroying the global economy. No one did access to oil. It would be unimaginable 2 years ago. Okay? So I think 2 years from now, there was a lot more, the world will be much more imaginable, unimaginable. Okay? So if you look at the two forces that are aggressively expanding throughout the world, it's Zionism, right? Because why are the Israelis, what are the Israelis doing in Argentina? There are a lot of Israelis right now in Argentina. And there are movements of Israelis to the Mediterranean, you know, where Jerusalem has bought Sassan Island in the Adriatic Sea of Albania. And that's caused a lot of problems, a lot of protests in Albania. So Zionism is expanding rapidly. Hindutva is the Hindu version of Zionism. And it's basically trying to expand the Indian diaspora, right? And that's why you see so many Indians in Australia, in Canada, in Europe, okay? It's being driven by this Hindutva ideology. And so what I think is naturally going to happen is this growing alliance between Zionism and Hindutva, right? Because if you're Israeli, you don't, there's not that many people in Israel. And there's a lot of people in India. So it makes sense to go to Argentina, buy all the land in Zion's capital, and then bring in Indian laborers to grow the place, right? Now, I think it's natural because if you look at issue in India, they're going really well. Like, there's only four countries in the world where Israel has a net favorability rating. And one of them is India. And I think that's for like Kenya and Kenya for whatever reason, okay? But it's not that many, okay? But one of them is India. And I think there's a deep rooted respect between the Jews and the Indians, right? So if you go to any American university, there are two ethnic groups that dominate, right? The Jews and the Indians. So I think there's a lot of natural synergy between these two groups. I don't see how Japan fits into this alliance, though. Maybe there is a possible solution to this, but I mean, like, if Japan were to join this alliance, then this would be a path forward for Japan. Well, I think that if you look at the global supply chain, Southeast Asia is particularly vulnerable. The reason why is you have a lot of people in Southeast Asia, not enough resources. Places like Indonesia, Malaysia, are going to face a lot of global turbulence over the next 10, 20 years. And if we focus on Japan, it seems Japan is in the worst case scenario because Japan is heavily industrialized, but it's also heavily dependent on global trade, especially on energy from the Middle East, and also food from other places. And so I think that Japan will be one of the first industrial nations to suffer the major repercussions and consequences of the Strait of Hormuz closure, and you will have a lot of problems in Japan. But I think that once these problems arise, once Japan recognizes how stark the future is, then I think that Japan will make some important changes that were previously unimaginable. And Japan will prove much more culturally resilient and flexible than other places. And I think it's partly because, like, the situation in Japan is particularly stark. And that's part one. Point two is, Japan, as the United States retreats from the Pacific theater, the United States sees Japan as its major proxy, okay? Because the United States is interested in divide and rule before it could use Pax Americana to control the world. But now that it cannot, because a lot of nations refuse to submit to American power, now America is forced to use divide and conquer. So Japan is the main proxy for America. And as a result, America will protect Japan. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, the Western Hemisphere is extremely rich, right? So you don't have Japan will have to suffer like in food or oil prices because it can continue to import this from the Western Hemisphere. Also, Japan is very wealthy, right? Japan has like $3.5 trillion invested overseas. It has like $1 trillion in U.S. Treasuries. So you pay more for food, but you're still getting food. I'm coming like a lot of places in Southeast Asia and Africa are going to starve to death. You're not having issues, okay? But I think that as a culture, as a people, the Japanese will also recognize that it's probably not a good idea to be completely dependent on America in the long term. And it's probably important to diversify and make some social changes to adapt to new reality. Okay, so I don't think the future in Japan is as bleak as people would imagine it to be.
Thank you.
Okay?
Yeah.
What I would say is this: young people throughout the world, especially in industrial economies, they no longer want to work, right? So America, you know, young people, they could choose to work in factories. There are lots of manufacturing jobs in America that pay really well. They don't want to do that. They would rather take whatever meager savings they have and go and gamble on cryptocurrency, right? The expectations and attitude and the values of the young people are really skewed. Maybe before my generation, to make $80,000 a year working as an engineer was considered really prestigious. Now young people, if you ask them like, what do you want to do and how much money do you want to make, their average expectation is to work as a social media influencer, like me, and make $600,000 a year. And then we're talking about a guy who's 21 years old. Right? It's insane what their expectations are. So this is a problem throughout the world. The thing I will say about Japan is that for whatever reason, there's still a sense of conscientiousness in Japan where if they do something, they want to do it well. And you don't really see that anymore around the world. I'm from China, I live in China, okay? And like, people don't take their work seriously. So even if Japan has problems, it's nowhere as bad as anywhere else. And I think a lot of it has to do with the cultural cohesion, where people would feel embarrassed if they didn't do a good job. So they'd rather not work rather than do a bad job. But in China and the United States, you have a lot of attitude where in China we have a phrase called bai lan, which is let it rot. Right? Rather do a good job, just do a terrible job because that's what other people deserve. Right? So in China, it's really strange, but the attitude is to express your individuality, to express your autonomy and agency, do a really crappy job. Because that's the only way to rebel against the system. Whereas I don't think this would ever happen in Japan. Taiwan, Japan would absolutely get involved in the war because, again, Japan sees Taiwan as vital to its core national self-interest because, you know, Taiwan would block Japan from accessing Southeast Asia and this would hurt Japan in the long term strategically, okay? But I think the chance of China actually invading Taiwan, it is extremely minuscule. And a lot of this has to do with Chinese geopolitical thinking, right? So what I have to say is the Americans play chess, which is direct, logical, and confrontational. Chinese play Go, which is indirect and long-term and very patient, okay? So China doesn't like military conflicts. China does whatever it can to avoid direct military confrontation. An example is Iran, where the only reason why Iran would agree to a ceasefire is China applied a lot of pressure on Iran, right? So go back, you know, to mid-April or April when the ceasefire was announced. I understand at that time why Iran would agree to the ceasefire. clearly Iran had a lot of the advantages, and clearly America was on the back foot. America was not prepared for a long war, and America, even Trump said this, we didn't expect them to close the Strait of Hormuz, we didn't expect them to attack GCC energy infrastructure. We weren't prepared for this, okay? So clearly America was on the back foot, Iran had a strategic advantage. So why stop the war? And the reason why you stop the war is China says, you guys stop the war because you're hurting the economy too much. You're hurting our economy. And China buys 9% of Iranian oil. So that's a lot of pressure, okay? But the way China does this is interesting. China never came out and said, oh, you know, we don't support this war or whatever. China got Pakistan to come in to be the mediator. Okay? That's how China operates. It's always behind the scenes, it's always back channels. China does not like competition. It creates a lot of issues for China. And Chinese are, there's a lot of Chinese strategic texts like, Sun Tzu, Art of War, and Romance of Three Kingdoms that determine how Chinese perceive strategy. Okay? So that's point one. China does not like military competition. Point number two is, right now, there is a political shift in Taiwan. There's a very charismatic chairwoman of the KMT, the opposition party in Taiwan, named Chung Ling-wen. And she's been saying, why are we fighting why is there a fight between China and Taiwan? We're just one big family. And she's very young, very charismatic, and she'll probably become the next president of Taiwan. And she's committed to peaceful reunification. She actually visited China, I think, a couple months ago, and she was greeted by the president. She was given, like, you know. KMT, yes. Yeah, that's right. The opposition party, right? The DPP is the one in charge. So if you just let things work out naturally, I think it makes a lot of sense for Taiwan and China to unify. And a lot of reason why is Taiwan's a very small place that depends on the Chinese mainland economy, right? So people just want a better standard of living, and so it makes more sense to reunify in the fight. And that's point two. Point three is the Americans actually are encouraging reunification between Taiwan and China, right? Like, just think about game theory and how I would behave if I'm Donald Trump. I want Taiwan to reunify with China. Why? Because first of all, China would give me a lot of benefits. For example, help me end this war in Iran. For example, buy my oil. For example, this is distance from itself from Russia, right? So if I'm in America, I'm like, fine, we reunify. What do I lose? I lose nothing. So China does not benefit at all from invading Taiwan. It may not even win militarily. That's the issue, right? Why give this huge chance when over time Taiwan and China was reunified naturally? Why would the United States give up Taiwan? And the reason why is Trump is transactional. Okay? He doesn't have any ideology. Taiwan's democratic, who cares? What can I trade Taiwan for? That's what he cares about, right? And because Taiwan is the ultimate national goal of China, China's actually willing to sacrifice a lot for Taiwan. Okay? So geopolitically, about America, I don't really lose that much by surrendering Taiwan. But I think I can gain a lot in China if I were to surrender Taiwan, including energy deals, right? Where China buys a lot of energy from me, including helping me deal with Iran, including creating friction between Russia and China. So remember what happened, right? Trump visits China, and then there's some secret meetings. And then after the meeting, Trump says to the reporter, you know what, I don't really care about Taiwan that much. And you know what, that arms shipment to Taiwan, forget about it. I'm not gonna give you weapons, okay? That's what Trump did. And then what happened was, Putin visits China to sign the Siberia pipeline deal. Okay? That didn't happen. That was supposed to happen, but it didn't happen. So clearly a deal was made.
This is a great question. I think there are certain explanations or certain reasons to compel Japanese cohesion. The first is that for the longest time, China was sort of gravity in East Asia, right? And so Japan always felt threatened by China, not just militarily, but culturally as well, right? So if you're Japan, how do you distinguish culturally from China? Because you obviously don't want to be colonized culturally by China, okay? So that's the first impetus for cohesion. The second is the continuity of the culture. So if you look at China, China is not a continuous culture. This is a great misunderstanding of China. So the last ethnic Chinese dynasty was the Han Dynasty in about the year 500, okay? After that, most Chinese were ethnic minorities. So the Tang Dynasty were not ethnic Chinese. They were what we call the Xianbeizu, okay, which is a Turkish people. But they disguised themselves as Chinese to better rule the people. Now, obviously, if you're ethnic Chinese, as opposed to if you are a minority, you're gonna govern the country differently, right? If you are ethnic Chinese, you believe in Greater China. You believe that it is China's destiny to expand outwards. And that's what the Han did, right? But if you are an ethnic minority, what you're first and foremost concerned about is maintaining your rule over the people, right? And so you want to maintain a more insular foreign policy. And that's what the Tang did, okay? So, and as more foreign rulers came to rule China, the Mongols, the Qing, these other groups, they really saw China as a plantation economy where they saw the people as a resource, as an energy to be exploited, to be extracted. All right, so that's China. Japan is different. Japan has never been conquered. It's been defeated, but it's never been conquered. It's a huge difference, right? So even though Japan lost in World War II, the Americans never imposed an American government on Japan. You can say, well, I mean, there really was no difference. Actually, a huge difference, okay? If the elite were American, Japan would be a very different place today. But the elite stayed Japanese, and as long as the Japanese adhere to certain American foreign policy objectives, the Americans left Japan alone, okay? So I think these are the two major reasons, because Japan needs to defend itself against Chinese cultural hegemony, and because Japan has stayed culturally homogeneous for most of its history. Not forever, but for most of its history. Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
If Trump allows the U.S. to take over Taiwan, as you've mentioned, Japan will be cut off. The sea link that connects its imports from the Middle East. So wouldn't that deteriorate Japan's economy? So I cannot imagine a situation in which Trump will allow Chinese to take over Taiwan.
So Trump knows there's no way Japan allows Taiwan to unify with China. And that's why he's encouraging it, right? Do you understand the logic of this? He's a business person, right? He's trying to create demand for three things: American energy, American resource, American weaponry, and American financing. He basically wants Japan to keep on buying US treasuries. And how do you do that? You create demand. And how do you do that? You create conflict, right? Because if China is willing to pay a lot of money for Taiwan, Japan will probably pay more money for Taiwan, right? He's a business person. That's how he behaves.
So you're saying that Trump is trying to implicate like its responsibility to Japan. Like she doesn't want Japan, she doesn't want China to take over Taiwan, but she wants like Japan to fight back on it, on itself.
He is a business person, and he understands that both China and Japan want Taiwan, right? So he's trying to trick both into bidding as much as possible for Taiwan, knowing neither will get Taiwan. So they're gonna bid infinitely. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay? Right? Because about Taiwan, think on this, about Taiwan, if I join China, Japan is pissed off at me. And Japan is a huge market for Taiwan, right? If Taiwan sides with Japan, China's screwed over. China's not pissed at me, right? And China will embargo me. So it's in my benefit to play both sides. Taiwan's playing both sides. The United States is playing both sides. How's it possible for China to take over Taiwan? Is it possible? Right?
I see. Okay. Oh, thank you. So, like,